Oh man, so good.
Do you got the tingles yet?
Oh man, it's so good.
Well, well, well.
Yeah.
We're here again.
On the set of Sister Act 2.
It's episode 2 here at Racks and Stacks. Again, whatever this thing becomes named. That's the name at the moment.
Oh my god. This is so good, dude.
I dug for this. I was thinking, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
You talked about it.
Yeah, we did.
And I was like, oh, I've got to play that.
Yeah, I thought about it too. A good buddy of mine from high school. A good buddy of mine from high school just got engaged this week, and I was thinking about all these like memories. He sang "Amazing Grace," and we did a bunch of other stuff for graduation. But he was there with me when these guys showed up, and it was incredible. Oh my god, so good. So good, man. So,
yeah.
How you doing, buddy?
Good. So I'm Gabe Besaw.
I'm Aaron Oster. And we're here.
We're here.
Yeah, man. Another week gone by. Another morning shift here over at the Racks and Stacks headquarters.
My dining room table.
Yeah.
This wonderful studio.
It's great, man. This is a lot of fun for me. Like, I'm really enjoying this. I was in high school. We had there was a buddy of mine. I think it was sophomore year. Came in and he bought a what was it called? We set up a pirate radio station in the basement of a church, and we had permission to do it from the school. But like, we definitely did not have permission from like the FCC to have this antenna that we set up. But it was juice and toast in the morning. Man. He now works for CNN. His responsibilities are like all the tech crews. So like all the trucks and the cameras and all the equipment and the guys who go out there on the field and like shoot those. I don't know what the position is called, but like that's his job, is to be in charge of all those people and all that equipment. And he was like always, he was the guy who like wore black. It was like pump up the volume with that guy, man. He was just like, and he's the one who really like pushed me into ska and like all this reggae and stuff like that. I mean, that Skarmageddon album that you lent me is like that was his gift to me.
Nice.
I mean, all that incredible music, and I loved the radio show. I just loved the format. I loved that you could hear people's voices and you didn't have to see them. You could be doing something else and listening to it. And it was great, and also that it was in high school. I felt like dangerous and yet also grown up. You know. This was like at the peak of like Opie and Anthony and Howard Stern and these guys. So like, you know, like DJs were, this was in the 90s, man. DJs were like big deal.
Hey, what's going on? Hey, I'm going to throw a pie in my face.
And we're back.
Hey,
Mr. Face. So yeah, I mean, I really sort of got the itch for it, but then, you know, you don't find a lot of. It just seemed like something fun that I did once in high school. So like to be back doing this is a lot of fun.
Yes. Yes. I sort of had the same thing. I had a wake up show on my school's inter-school television channel.
No way.
Yeah. So that was my introduction to DJing. I would stay up until 4 in the morning and record videos off of MTV to play on my show.
Oh my god.
And yes, lots of great times. Shout out Todd Murray, Jay Casilla, Todd Pastor.
Wow. Yeah. That was Oliver Janney, man. OJ.
OJ.
Oh, good times. I wanted to be the kid from 90210, David.
Yeah, that guy.
I want to be cool like David and have my own radio show inside TV.
Oh, man.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you got it now, buddy.
I do. And I control the mic. I can do whatever I want.
You're doing it.
Oh, yeah. So, it's been a whole week. It's 5:30. That's why we have these wonderful voices in the morning.
That's right.
Deep voice.
That's right.
Barry White voices.
So what do you want to talk about this week, man?
Let's talk about you a little bit.
Okay.
You directed questions at myself, so let's talk about you. So what was your first kind of experience with food that was like, this makes me, I like this. This is interesting. What's,
you know, I think, well, Gabe, I feel like, I grew up in a house where food was pretty, you know, you grew up in a Jewish home and like the big joke is, you know, what's the worst thing about a Jewish funeral is when the catering's bad. You know, like there's food for every scenario, everything. It's always there. Like my mom and dad, I grew up in a house where my mom and dad made breakfast every morning. We sat around the table for dinner and for breakfast. Both my parents worked from home primarily through most of my life. They had their own business. My dad had a consulting business. My mom is a designer. She's a decorator. So, they worked out of the house, so we had dinner. My mom cooked dinner every night. My sister had, excuse me, that was a 5:30 a.m. coffee burp. my sister is a good cook. She's a great cook. My mom's a great cook. My grandmother, who just passed, she was an incredible cook. That was my mother's grandmother. My father's grandmother was a terrible cook. But I think that's just because she's Russian, and that food is mostly made with sadness and tears.
Da.
He's about to, you cry into the chicken, and then you cook. You marinate with the tears of your sadness, and then you have flavor. So I think like the idea of food being a thing that gets people together around the table as a sort of invitation to have good conversation and laugh and yell and be together was kind of the beginning of it. But like, I remember we used to go to Florida as a kid, and my dad used to like these like frozen drinks, and so I was like, oh, I can make some frozen drinks. So then we would go to the house, and I would like get out the blender, and I would like put ice and bananas and whatever other weird stuff I wanted to put into it, and then I would like serve it to my dad and my mom and my sister. And I am sure that they did not enjoy them. but it was just something that I liked to do. When friends were over, I was like, oh, look what I can do. When my parents had guests over, I would just make frozen drinks or do something, you know. Peanut butter on celery sticks with, like, carrots. Or with, like, raisins on top or stuff like that, you know. But my grandmother had a couple, like, solid recipes. Not a couple, she had a lot, but like she had ones that were like stood out as like these are hers, like these dill pickles that she used to make that were like paper thin, that were very sweet dill pickles. And then she'd make this Hungarian dish called it pechinassos, which is like it's like a bechamel, which is like milk and flour and butter, and you sort of make this like, this thick mixture, and she added a lot of dill. I don't know why dill was so popular in Hungary, but I guess so. A lot of dill and a lot of saffron, so it was like this really rich, deep flavors. And then she would put chicken in there and then bake the chicken in there, and it was really good.
Was it kind of a big dill?
hey,
coming at you now.
Yeah, okay, great.
There we go.
Okay, this is the dad cast.
I successfully used a
you nailed it,
a
dude.
Pad.
You nailed it. So that was kind of like, I must have been 5 or 6 when I was doing that kind of stuff. So like, I feel like I've always been around the concept that food was a thing to bring people together and it meant fun. But professionally, was 99, 2000. I was dating a girl who was living in Boston, and she had a roommate who was dating a guy who was a chef at the Ritz-Carlton in Boston. And she knew I liked to cook. I was like the guy in my friend group who like knew how to cook, and that was my thing. It was like play some Dave Matthews on the guitar and make dinner. You know, that was like, oh, I need some things, you know. I don't play Dave Matthews anymore, but
he's the guitar guy.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly. Oh, and he can cook. Oh my God, Aaron.
Oh, he's dreamy.
Yeah. So
that you are dreamy, actually.
Oh, sweetheart. You're so sweet. Yeah. So like, I really felt like, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I had famously failed out of college twice, and this was my second time failing out of college. I was going to the New School in New York to study film, and I was kind of like in between stuff. I had a part-time job as a tailor's apprentice down in the West Village, and I was like, I don't know what I want to do. And so I went up to see her one, took the Chinatown bus from New York, which, if people don't know, that was a bus that for $10 you could get from New York to Boston. It was a white knuckler all the way. Was definitely passing people in the left lane with this bus full of, 70 people, but you got there. And so she arranged for her roommate's boyfriend to give me a night in the kitchen. And I think I was hooked. I went and bought a knife, and like, I showed up and I didn't know what I was doing. And he's like, put the knife down. He's like, you're not going to cut anything. So he just set me with like, pulling chickens apart and, cleaning salad greens. But then I got to watch service, which was the real special thing. And so you're in this space, and the kitchen was a pretty big kitchen, and the dining room probably sat 120, something like that, 150. But it was like screaming, 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 yelling, yelling, fire, fire, like actual fire, volume all the way up straight to like to 11. And then just like that, like 15 identical dishes that were perfect showed up in the pass. And then they went out to the tables. And I was like, oh my God, that's awesome. I mean, it was just something about that. That was like this really chaotic thrash metal ballet where it's like a bunch of weirdly weird dudes and women made really beautiful looking food, but they didn't look beautiful. You know, like when you see ballet or you see like the orchestra and you're like, oh, this music is stunning and everyone's wearing like black tie and they're very formal, and you're like, oh, the people creating this matches the creation, right? Like they work together. This was not that. This was a bunch of lunatic pirates with like anger and bags in their under their eyes, like real, I don't want to say misery, but like intensity. And then like they produced this gorgeous stuff, and I was like, this is incredible. These are my people. So I sat and talked to this guy after service. His name is Dante de Magistresis. He's still a chef in Boston. And he arranged for me to meet Jeffrey Zakarian, who's a chef in New York. And
GZ, as they call him on TV. Yeah. Hey, GZ.
Oh, man. He's an interesting guy. I'll say this about Jeffrey. Like, this was in early 2000s. He was kind of at the top of his game here. And we were in this hotel in Midtown on West 56th Street. And I walked down there, and he hired me as per Dante's. I mean, I showed up there like with a suit on, and he's like, what are you doing? Like, I was like, I want to work. He's like, go home, get changed, come back. Like, do you look like you're not ready to work? He just put me in the dish pit and just had me like clean and dry pots and pans. And then eventually I kind of worked my way up through that kitchen for a couple of years and then moved around. I was telling someone this story recently. Like, I went so aggressively one direction, which was to try to be the apprentice who learned everything. But even though I was trying to be an apprentice, I didn't have any real patience. Like, you never forget your first time in like a magical sphere, and you know, your magical sphere experience could be like, you know, the first time you DJ'd a party. It's never going to be as awesome as it was that first time. You're going to chase it. I mean, drugs were very much the same way for me. But like, it's the stoke, man. Like, it's first time you go snowboarding, first time you get up on a surfboard. Like, I did this thing by myself. It's really incredible. Like, first time working in a kitchen, the line during service at a 3-star restaurant in Midtown Manhattan. across from like Harry Winston and like Norma Kamali, which are like big names in fashion and like jewelry design, and like we're in this really special boutique hotel, and like Naomi Campbell and like Brad Pitt are at the bar, and it's like really high end shit, and you feel like you're on top of the world. But like I was chasing that, and I didn't realize that like it's cool, but there's work in there, you know, and the real wisdom is in the work. You have to do the work. You have to work on the everything was new. So until you accept the repetition, like, I don't know if you ever saw that movie Jiro, Dreams of Sushi. If you haven't seen it, you should watch it. It's a great one. It's about the only three Michelin starred, well, the first three Michelin starred sushi restaurant in a subway station in Tokyo. Like reservation only. The whole meal, I think, is done in like 20 to 25 minutes. Like everything is made for you in a particular order. Perfect. And it's about this guy's dedication to the his commitment to trying to attain perfection. I mean, it's very Zen in that particular way. But it's about repetition, you know? And I didn't realize that. I didn't have anybody who was sort of like, dude, just calm down. Like, just pace yourself. I could have spent 5 or 6 years just at that one restaurant, and I would have been incredible. But instead, I moved around a lot. Mostly because I started cooking. Because I didn't fit into school. I didn't fit into, like, the regular scheme of things. So, like, when my dad was like, you need to go back and get your undergrad, I was like, screw you, old man. Like, I'm not going anywhere.
You can't tell me what to do.
Yeah, like, I'm going to show you. I'm going to cook. And he's like, you're wasting your energy. You're wasting your talent. I was like, no, screw you. I'll show you. I'll be the best. And so I moved around a lot to try to move up quickly, which is something that young cooks often do, which is they... is my volume okay?
Yeah. You're great.
Something that young cooks often do, which is that they move around after the first 2 years every year or so, which shows that they've got experience, quote unquote, but they don't have the experience is sort of like a wading pool. It's wide and shallow. It's not deep. And so there's no real depth of experience or understanding. It's all just like, this is what a burger looks like, but there's no understanding of why is this bread the right bread? Why is the lettuce in this particular order when it's arranged? What is the cheese? How is the burger ground? What is the mix of the grind? Like, what are the condiments? How is it being arranged? How is it being grilled? It's just like, yeah, my chef made this burger and this is what a burger looks like. And it's like, okay, well, you can't replicate it. You can't train it. You can't cost it. You can't do anything to it. You're just, it's this, I think it's called the Dunning-Kruger curve. I might have that wrong, but it's this curve where you have just enough experience to where you're dangerous and where you think you know more than you do. And then that's sort of like that plateaus and declines after a certain period of time.
And isn't that called your early 20s?
Yeah, sure is. Sure is. So like that was basically where I started. And so I moved around a lot and really just, I'm a quick study when someone shows me how to do something. So I was kind of able to kind of hold my own, but ultimately like I was a jerk, and like I took jobs and left after 6 months because I had applied for two jobs and then the second job called and I'd go to that other one. And I think I knew I was in the right world, but I didn't really find a mentor until much later. Somebody who was like, I'm going to push you hard. And somebody who saw that I wanted to do this, but also just was like, you need to know more than you know. And you can't pretend to be a clown if you don't know what the hell you're talking about. He had this great analogy that like, this is the guy, Cesare Casella, who was like my mentor, my big teacher. He would always say the clown is the one member of the circus who has the pulse, who knows the most. They're the most talented. They're the most versatile. They can see everything, and you can't act a clown until you know what the hell you're talking about. It was a thick Italian accent.
Easy. You cannot be a clown if you don't know what you talk about.
But like, I mean,
it's a good quote.
It's true. You know, like you see guys like Jimmy Fallon, for example, you know, just as whatever you feel about Jimmy Fallon, Johnny Carson, the guy knows what he's talking about. That's why he can joke around, and that's why he can do this, because like he's in that seat because he knows what the hell he's doing. Mm-hmm. And so you can't get there until you do the work, and you got to be humble to do the work because the work is tough. So, yeah, I really, I kind of started back in 2000 and then just kind of worked my way through. And that was the beginning of it, you know, back then.
It's interesting now. You're 40.
Almost. I'll be 40 in June.
Yes. So I'm officially 40, 44.
Yeah.
So as we're getting to our middle life here, I think we're both getting to see those times where the early 20s are full of lots of excitement and energy and all of that stuff. And then there's older people that are like, wait, hang on, just totally slow down, relax, enjoy.
Yeah, we were talking about this. It's just, you know, I find myself surrounded by 20-year-olds these days. Because I employ them. That sounded bad. I employ people in their 20s. Not exclusively, but that's just kind of how it works out. Because we're not hiring people with any real relative experience. We're hiring people who have good attitudes and have good hearts, and we can teach them to cook a burger. I don't need you to have experience how to cook a burger.
Or wonderful brisket.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and so all of the skills... All of the skills that I've acquired, I grew up in a time when knowing that information was sacred, and so people were reluctant to share recipes unless you were sort of on the inside. But I don't feel as though there's anything new about what I'm doing at all. Certainly not baked beans and coleslaw and brisket. Like, I didn't invent this, and I'm a Russian Hungarian Jew from Connecticut, so like, doesn't belong to me at all. I mean,
but it's so tasty.
It's super tasty, but like, I've been a chef for a long time. I know how to smoke meat. Like, I can figure it out. I mean, I hate to say it, make it sound like it's easy. It's not, but like, it's also not brain surgery.
You know? Understand the process.
I understand the process. That's right. You know? So, you know, like you're a glazer and you do this really delicate finish work. But if someone asked you, just like the thing you showed me today, you know, that, you know, cladding this particular column with these metal sheets, it's like it's the same kind of delicate, sensitive work that you have the skill set to accomplish. Maybe that's not how you were officially trained to do, but like all the skills are there: measuring, cutting, you know, like assembling, screwing in, like fastening. Those are all skills. Same thing with brisket. It's like, I know how to smoke, I know how to trim, I know how to cut, I know how to identify, I know how to work with fire. Like, I have necessary tools to do this. But when I'm around these kids, you know, I forget what it was like to be in my 20s. And it was chaotic. Like, I feel like every day was, I don't know what I'm doing, which is totally fine. And then some days it was like, I know exactly what I'm doing, old man. Like, let me tell you, you know. And you know, it's a bit of a balance. And for me, since I don't have kids, I've never raised kids. I think it's interesting to sort of reconcile that with myself and be like, you know, if you're leading these people, you know, we're saying like, you need to establish some minimum standards and empower them to make good decisions, but also like, I don't want to micromanage people, you know. And when I was in my 20s, man, good Lord, I had someone's boot on my neck, like, and I don't really want to do that, but I don't want to say that there wasn't value there, you know, like, that wasn't me who did it. Someone else's boot was on my neck, but their boot was on my neck because I mean this, they love me, you know. So like, there was affection there, and it was like, you need to work harder on this. You know, a guy I worked with on the line, he's like, listen, whatever the chef says, just say yes, chef, no, chef, I don't know, chef. But if he stops talking to you, start looking for work. So it was kind of like, if the chef is breaking your proverbials, you know, and is giving you a hard time, like, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
And that means you need to keep focused. But if they stop talking to you and they stop caring that you're screwing up, they've already replaced you, so to speak. So it's tough being around the younger kids, because I realize that there's so much that I, this is the second part of being a business owner, is being a leader and a parent, for lack of a better word, to these kids. And it's the thing, like, I know how to do the work. Now the real lesson begins of, like, how do I disseminate that information that I know and still get the same product?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the parenting. I mean, they do call me Meat Daddy, as I was saying it, as I was saying last week. But it is true. Like, I have to, I mean, I'm sure you feel the same way with your kids. It's like, you know, you've been establishing these boundaries and these guidelines for them to live their lives by. And the more those can set, you know, if it's like concrete, I imagine the stronger that they're going to be as they go out into the world. You know, how are you, I mean, when you have young guys on your crew, like, how do you work? I mean, when it's not Caleb, you know, yeah.
You don't want to be my son when you're working on my crew, because I expect an awful lot.
Yeah.
Patiently, but I expect an awful lot. And honestly, my crews, I expect high standards out of everybody, especially on job sites, as far as the work goes, the craftsmanship, the attention to detail. I don't know everything. And I'll admit, when I've had guys like younger and not experienced come up with other ideas for things and how to way to put glass in or whatever, and it's a great idea.
Yeah.
I'm cool with that. I'm cool with not having all the answers, but I know a basic foundation. And I think, like you're saying, in the kitchen, it's knowing, here's all the bits and pieces. This is why we do it the way that we do it. Yeah. And then we put it together and it looks amazing.
Yeah.
And it stands up and...
And then it tastes good, and there's, like, you can be proud of that. And the hard thing is that sometimes you work with people who, I don't have anyone like this on my crew now, but I've had them in the past where they have a good idea, and then that becomes like a golden ticket for them to have all the good ideas. And it's like, that's not how it works. You know, like, sometimes you can thread the needle and you can sort of see that that's the right thing to do. But also, like, I still know more than you, you know, and not not in an egotistical way, but like, there's still more you have to learn.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't got it all figured out. But then I see that part of myself in that person, and I'm like, oh, okay, we'll back it up a few steps, you know. But so
it gives you a little more ability if you take the time to sort of see it now and realize that, yes, I can have patience with that person, because that was totally me.
Yeah. I mean, now I have more patience. That's my job, is to have patience. My job is to make sure that I can keep my proverbial shit together, so that these guys, they don't freak out. Because I know, you know, like, we set the tone. You know, it's always, I think it's always that way. You know, whether you're, when it, no matter what the job is, you know, the tone is set by the people on top. And I'm guilty of being slacking off. I'm guilty of being lazy, sometimes just delegating too much, not delegating enough, making myself insane. Like, I've done it all, and still do, you know, from time to time. But it has to start from the top. And so I think when I wake up in the morning, it's kind of like, yeah, that's my goal, is to make sure that these guys feel supported and that they see the right way to do things, but also that they're clear what their expectations are. And I think when I started cooking professionally, that was very clear. The standard of excellence was very, very clear. And I don't know, it's easier in a fine dining restaurant to clarify that. You know, when you're just doing barbecue, it's like, whatever, just barbecue. It's like,
It's still food.
It's still food, man. It's
still the process.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a learning process. It all starts with me. It doesn't start with them. I don't start going around blaming people. Like, that's the wisdom that I picked up, is like, it's on me to make this better. It's not on them. They don't know. They work for me. They work for Alex, you know. And we all, I don't like to say that they work for me. I like to say we work together, because I can't do it without them. and they can't do it without me. Mm-hmm. So it's, it really is a team effort, but I kind of got off on a tangent there. Sorry.
No, that was good.
Yeah.
So you said that your dad was very anti you going into the food and all of that, and was like, you're wasting your time.
Yeah.
Was there ever a moment where that came back?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we didn't talk for a few years, but I ended up in 2004. I'd spent 4 years busting ass in the restaurant, just working 100-hour weeks nonstop. I mean, just a rough patch. And ultimately, Valentine's Day 2004, I was working at this place in New Jersey, in Newark, at the Robert Treat Hotel. It's like not a great hotel, per se.
Well, it was all. Newark, New Jersey.
Hey, man, you know, like, I was going to tell you, like, Newark, everyone thought I was nuts for taking this job, and I was nuts for taking this job. Like, let's just be real. Like, I was a three-and-a-half-year-old, four-year-old cook. I didn't know anything. And they were like, hey, we know you came for this executive sous chef position, but it actually turns out it's a chef position, so would you like it? And I was like, yeah, I'm totally ready to do this. I was not ready to do this. And ultimately, I think that the restaurant was looking for to file Chapter 11, and so they wanted to hire someone who didn't know what the hell they were doing to run it. At any rate, it was a nightmare. The New Jersey Performing Arts Center, the NJ PAC, had just opened across the street from the hotel, and Newark was sort of going through this renaissance, is a very generous word, but like really trying to like get their shit together. There is a beautiful section of Newark called the Ironbound section, which is this Portuguese neighborhood, Portuguese and Brazilian neighborhood, that's just on the other side of the tracks, and it's incredible. I mean, it's like it's a jewel. Like, incredible clubs, live music, great barbershops, incredible grocery stores, incredible food, like, the smell of, like, bacala and, like, just live guitar and dancing. I mean, it was really incredible. Like, really incredible neighborhood. And so I was kind of, like, I was kind of attracted to this. And, of course, I was super overconfident, so I thought I could do everything. So, but Valentine's Day, I had designed a whole new menu, and then they started selling the old menu in the middle of service. So imagine, if you will, my crushed ego, and also just like the stupidity of these people. I don't call people stupid, but these guys did not deserve to be in the restaurant business. They really were not doing anyone any favors. So like, old guests would come in, instead of being like, hey, we have a new chef, like, we have a new menu, they'd be like, oh, you want the old food? Sure, no problem, 1 second. And they'd sell it. And it's like, we don't have those ingredients anymore. Yeah, we'll just, like, do this or just do that. It's like, no. So I walked out Valentine's Day. I called my dad. I said, I'm coming home. And I ended up stopping cooking for a while. I went back to junior college. I went and studied business at Norwalk Community College, got an internship and a job at JP Morgan, and worked there for a couple years while I got into school and was finishing my undergrad at Pace University in New York City. And studied accounting, and I had a really good time at the bank. I mean, it was fun work. It was definitely not food related at all, but they paid me a lot of money as an intern. Like, even as an intern, it was like crazy. And I was older than all the other interns. All the other interns were like 18, 19 years old. I was like 24. I was like,
you're like the 10th grader who has the mustache.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. I was the 10th grader.
Well, he's got a mustache.
Yeah.
He's 75.
Yeah. I mean, like, I was definitely, the vet, but it, because I had, because I was hungry to learn and to grow in my career at that point, and I mean career like is in my life, in my 20s, I was looking for guidance. And so I found this incredible guy, Ken Garola, who was assigned as my mentor, and he really pushed me. He's like, I want you to go out and get 100 contacts. I want you to call them all back. I want you to, like, and gave me lots of, like, exercises and homework to build my confidence and to push myself to get the most out of this opportunity. And ultimately I got offered a job, and I worked there for, I guess 6 months after my internship, 8 months after my internship, and then I just couldn't do it. Everybody was talking about their next life, and I was like, I want to do something in this life, and I want to be happy doing it. And it was good, but, like, it was boring. I mean, it wasn't boring. It just was, I was bored. I was, like, extremely anxious, and I just wanted to get out, and I wanted to be doing the thing that I was doing before, which was feeling the magic of this restaurant world and, like, the energy and the pulse and, like, you're doing something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was sitting in front of Excel spreadsheets all day long, which, I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, but, like, man, you're not building anything. So I wanted to, like, make something. And so I got a job. I called Ken, and I said, Ken, I'm thinking about going back into food. And he's like, oh, it turns out my roommate from college is a really famous chef from San Francisco. So I called him, and we just started talking. And this guy, Rod Aglabot, may he rest in peace, died during COVID. It was really terrible. He was like, yeah, dude, I got some people. And he called a friend of his, and that friend got me a job. And I started working in the kitchen again, you know? But, like, it was a recurring thing where, like, I was looking for mentors. I was looking for guidance. I wanted to be somebody's, like, project.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to learn from a great master. And it wasn't until 2000. It wasn't, I know, sweetheart. Yeah, the mascot is here. Yeah, the Racks and Stacks mascot's here.
He wants food, so
yeah.
That's, if you hear whimpering, it's just my dog wanting food.
Yeah, so like it was a recurring theme for me. I wanted to be somebody's mentee, and over the years I sort of picked up these great mentors, and it wasn't until 2008 that I started working for Cesare, this Italian guy. And he really...
That's not somebody peeing. That's the dog drinking.
That was when I started, I would say, really growing professionally. And then, like, I had learned skills. I had done things. But this was when I was really on top of it. Hey, bud.
Can we pause for 1 second?
Yeah. And we're back!
Hey! Whoa!
Yeah, sorry. So we were talking about back in 2008 when I started working with Cesare. He was this formative mentor of mine, still is. You know, his big thing was building this sort of, like, experience. And he's the one who really took me to Italy. I got the job. So my first job out of finance, this woman, Alexis Pisciotta, was my sous chef. And Alexis and I had stayed in touch. I went and traveled around Europe for 6 months, 7 months. And Alexis called me and she's like, hey, I got a job. If you can get yourself back to the States, there's a sous chef position for you at this restaurant. And just to give you an idea of where I was mentally, I was trying to write my memoirs at 26, you know, like, man, I really thought I was, like, had a really important story to tell Gabe, you know, like, I mean, I traveled, man, and I'd done some things. No, had not done a thing. I was like, I was unemployed, and I was living in Sweden, in Stockholm, with my fiance at the time, and, man, like, I was just stuck. Can't work in Sweden without like a visa or a work card, and can't really get one of those unless you're married to a Swede or you are Swedish. I couldn't get a job washing dishes. I couldn't get a job sweeping floors. Like, nobody would hire me. So I was kind of just stuck up in the apartment while my fiance at the time was, like, working on all these projects, and so, who I had met at business school. And I was like, you know, I'm going to go back to New York. I got this job. We'll just see how it goes. So I got on a plane. I borrowed $700, which I don't think I paid back now that I think about it.
Sorry.
Nope. that's great. Maybe I'll write a check one day. I got back to New York. I cooked for this man, Cesare and Alexis. And I roasted a chicken. I put together some vegetables. I made some polenta and like grilled shrimp. And I don't know. I did like four or five things pretty easily. Just like for fun. Just like good. And he's like, hey, you have a job. So I got the job. And then we got on a plane, I don't know, 2 weeks later, and went to Milan and walked around New York and walked around Milan and Florence and small towns throughout Tuscany, including Lucca, where he's from, to give us the real genuine impression of what it was to build a salumeria, which is what we were doing in New York. And a salumeria is a place where you've got a little market up front. They sell some antipasta, like some caponata or like some beans or some cheeses, some sliced meats, but also a little place to sit as well, too. So, you know, it's a 1,000-square-feet restaurant on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, but we were busy. Like, I think we had a couple days there where we had done 300 covers in a day, which with a 25-seat restaurant is like, that's a lot. So, and Cesare remains my mentor to this day, you know. He has a bunch of other projects, but he was the first one who really showed me, like, you need to push a lot. And we did some wild stuff together. Oh my God. Just thinking about it, it's incredible. But Cesare is, oh my God. I don't know how to describe him. He's a beast. Like, he's just an absolute beast. He's a Michelin starred chef from Tuscany, took over his parents' restaurant. But Cesare, when he first got to this country, there's a couple different versions of the story. I think this is the right one. He was doing a pop-up dinner at the Four Seasons, which is this really fancy restaurant in Midtown on the East Side, on Park Ave. And his childhood friend, Julian Nicolini, who was the GM of this restaurant, and invited him to come do like a pop-up and cook at the place, right? And so Julian's from Monte Catini, which is just down the street from Lucca in Tuscany, and so to speak, down the street. Cesare walked into the restaurant, and he saw that everybody had like pocket squares and stuff. So he went to the kitchen and he grabbed a bunch of like rosemary, and he shoved it into his pocket, and that was like his thing. I think he did it when he was back in Tuscany as well too, but like, this was his coming out party, so to speak, in the States, and that was his thing. And so everywhere he'd go, he'd wear these like big crazy purple jackets, and like, you know, like, you remember that scene from when like a European Vacation, right, from National Lampoon's, when they go to Italy and like they're wearing all that weird clothes, like that Cesare just dressed like insane. Like he'd have like alligator New Balance, you know, and like he would just have big orange pants and like wear like a massive purple jacket or whatever, and he pulled it off, man. But always with that big bunch of rosemary in his, oh man, he's just incredible, larger than life, huge heart. And we used to take walks. He's the one who was really became my surrogate father in those moments where like my dad didn't understand what I was doing. So I couldn't listen to his advice. And so Cesare was there for me to be like, I mean, many times would say things like, there's no way that you can take care of yourself. You can't take care of anyone else if you don't know what the hell you're doing. If you can't take care of yourself, if you don't know what decisions feel good to you, how are you supposed to make decisions for other people? And so we still talk. He runs a center up in Hurleyville, New York, in, I don't know what county that's in, but it's in the Catskills. And it's the Center for Autistic Kids called the Center for Discovery and Thanksgiving Farms. And Cesare is he's the culinary director of this program that houses, I think, like 100, 200 severely autistic kids, and I think the full staff of the program is like 1,600 people, and they've built a sustainable program. He brought beef over from Italy, developed his own breed of pig, They've got their own chickens. They make their own bread. They grow their own spices, their own vegetables, like all holistic, all natural, like really incredible program. And he's changing the lives of these people who, for the most part, as autistic kids in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, were kind of thrown away. Mm-hmm. I mean, like in the 80s, if you had autism, you were institutionalized. And so this guy, Patrick Dollard, connected with Cesare, and Patrick was the guy who was literally going into these centers, going into like these asylums and taking these autistic people out and bringing them out and housing them and feeding them like food, like real food, not the garbage, like processed stuff, but like real vegetables, and noticing a significant change. So food and like animal husbandry and working on the farm is part of what they were, what their goal is. Everything good?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So a big part of what they do is not just protecting, but also like building a sustainable ecosystem for these incredible people and getting them involved in all the work that needs to get done on the farm. So it was also the first time I was with somebody who was sort of showing me what you could do in the food world outside of just cooking and just being a chef. Like, this is like, no, you can actually make a difference in the world, and here's how you do it. So what I think I was saying was that Cesare was the first person who showed me that there was like life outside of the kitchen, and that you could actually make a bigger impression on the world with food. And that's kind of where I find myself now. But you know, when you're young, you see people doing things that are cooler than just peeling potatoes, and you're like, I want to do that. But there's a lot of work between peeling potatoes and running a sustainable center for autistic kids in upstate New York. It's a lot to do. So, you know, developing patience and staying on the path, so to speak, it's all a long game, which you don't realize when you're in your 20s. You want it all now. Mm-hmm. And so, much to the same point of the conversation we've been having recently, is like, kids are, I forget how impetuous like 20-year-olds are, and how I was when I was 20, and that's like, now, oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, I was a pain in the ass. So,
yeah, and yeah, it's funny how I'm the older I get, the more tired I get. And I think about all the energy that I wasted in my 20s, staying up late and playing video games and doing all of those.
I mean, was it wasted?
Nah, really? I mean, okay, maybe it wasn't wasted, but I wish I had some of that energy back.
Yeah, but I feel like we have a little bit more intention of the work that we do now. Like, when we do spend time off or we go do things, like, I feel like I get to enjoy it a lot more. Like, I couldn't enjoy it when I was in my 20s the same way. I didn't have the same perspective, and I don't appreciate it as much. So when I have time off or when I'm working on something that really means something to me, I can really enjoy it much more, and at a much slower pace, which is, I don't know, I mean, it's just getting older, you know?
It's like this podcast this morning.
Yeah, I mean, it's whatever, dude. It's been a lot of fun, so.
Yeah, so, the process is pretty amazing. I once had a boss who, when I first got into glazing, the owner of the company was my boss, and I worked pretty exclusively with him. And what I learned from him was that there was no job too small or too big for him to do. So his lead by example was, if trash needs to be picked up, that's what I'm going to do, because that's where I'm best used. And there's so many lessons that can be learned from that. It all has to be done, and it's all going to be done by somebody. And you don't have to be a fully trained guy to pick up trash.
No, but you need to have the eyes. Like, that's the hardest thing to train. What was that like on those jobs when you first started? I mean, do people sort of have that? Is there a hierarchy that exists where you sort of start as like pushing a broom, or you're like, I don't know, cutting the tips off silicone?
Yeah, there's always going to be a gopher.
Yeah.
There's always a guy that's got to, oh, go get this, go get that, you know. And that guy is extremely important because he keeps everybody else moving.
Yeah.
And it's important to be able to trust that person to be, oh, they got the right thing, and then sort of setting it out on a job site. That's incredibly important because that's the guy who sets the pace. That's the guy who keeps everybody fed and keeps moving.
Yeah.
It's like a roofer. You can't put those shingles down if somebody doesn't bring up the bundles, and carrying bundles sucks, but yeah, it's got to be done.
It's an important job.
Yes, absolutely. And it leads to groundwork. And I learned so much from that that boss about how to lead people. Because you look around and try to slot people into spaces that they can be best used and provide the best result. But you also have to be willing to just slide in and do whatever you need to do. And I'm sure you in the kitchen, you know what's got to be done. And
yeah,
sometimes you have to cut potatoes.
Yeah, sometimes you gotta sweep them up. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. I'm totally admitting defeat here, but I also notice when it doesn't go right. Like, it's very clear to me when I have when I've done a bad job of setting up my team. Or being the person who's sort of when my expectations are unrealistic, it's crazy. And in the restaurant industry, things can change really quickly. So like I can notice that and then like take a breath, step back, readjust, move things around. But it's a daily progress. Like it's a daily process. It's not set up and it doesn't run automatically. Like it needs to be fed. Like it needs to be fed direction. Otherwise, it just falls apart. And I don't think that that's necessarily my, I don't want to say fault, but like, I think that's the nature of any business that requires manual labor, is that you need to keep pushing the rock, so to speak. You need to keep pushing the boulder uphill. And that means that like whoever's leading that job site needs to be focused, and whoever's the gopher needs to understand what their expectations are, and the rest of the team needs to understand what their positions and their roles are. But there needs to be a little bit of, I won't say pressure, but there needs to be a little bit of tension, so to speak, against the deadline or against the standard to try to get the result that everybody wants in order to get hired again or to just feel good about yourself at the end of the day. And I noticed that oftentimes I want it to run automatically, and that's how I act. It's like, yeah, you guys got it, right? Okay. I'm gonna go make phone calls that I don't want to make in the office for 4 hours. But you know, it's important to keep that pressure on. You know, especially I mean, your job is a lot more dangerous than mine for sure. You know, piece of glass falls. That's what we call a bad day, right?
It can be.
Yeah,
that's all right. Totally lost my train of thought, which is pretty much this episode. So, yeah, I sit across from Aaron and realize that my life experience is so small compared to yours.
Come on, man.
Yeah, I feel pretty stupid with all of your where you've been and what you've done, and that's cool to me that you've had the ability to live in different places and see so many different things. And when we get into music at some point, again, I'm going to feel very inadequate in my experiences. What? Oh yeah. Just, I don't know.
Dude, you're an encyclopedia.
Yeah, I may be an encyclopedia, but I don't know. I can see your knowledge.
I'm flattered. I'm truly am flattered, but like it is a rude awakening at how much I don't know every single day. And I don't mean to say like I'm the egotist who's like, yeah, I know so much, and when I don't know something, it's a surprise. I know that I know very little, but like I feel the same way when I talk to the people in my profession who have like worked and lived in all these other places and done all these things. And I think what I'm realizing now is that like it all comes down to the same core components. It doesn't matter what language you're speaking. It doesn't matter what food you're cooking. It doesn't matter the size or the space of the kitchen. It's all the same. It's all the same. It's the same everywhere, which is communication, integrity, and like humility. Like you can possess those three traits on a job site. It's you're gonna go through the same process. There's a couple of books I've been reading now as I've sort of been diving, like as I was saying last week, into sort of Eastern philosophy a little bit deeper. It's really the same. Long game, patience. You know, I am the idea of like Zen of like I am nothing is maybe a little bit intense for this conversation, but like, you know, humility, be humble, be present, don't get ahead of yourself. Focus on the work that's in front of you. Focus on it with like a full heart and like be dedicated to it, and don't judge, don't react, just assess and execute. You know, like I remember. Sort of a sidebar here. Before I had opened this, I was opening this project out in Vegas with a buddy of mine, and we were in New York doing like interviews and like going around to like different places to sort of scope out different stuff, and just to get the vibe that we were looking for, you know, for inspiration for certain dishes, but also just to see some cool stuff in the city. And one of the partners who was hiring us, he had a buddy who we grew up with who was worked for the Port Authority. And took us up to the 106th story of the Freedom Tower before it was built. Like when it was just I-beams exposed up there at the top of the world. And, you know, we got to see this really incredible thing up close. And, you know, like fundamentally, that kind of perspective at the top of the world was pretty incredible. But you see that there were guys welding, there were guys sweeping, there were guys taking out trash, there were guys doing all the stuff on that job site. It's all the same in the sense that like that hierarchy, that method of teaching and staying focused. I mean, these guys are hanging 106 stories off the side of a building.
That's intense.
It's wild. But again, like it made me feel, I don't want to say like a kindred, but like it made me feel, proud of the work that I do. And the more that I get to do it, the more that I get better at it and the more that I get to grow and like learn. Oh man, that was an interesting sound.
That was crazy.
Yeah. The springs are still vibrating. Wah, wah, wah.
I'm making it worse.
Anyway, yeah, it was just. I find that the more that I have responsibility over a business and employees, that I'm getting better at it. And when I get down on myself for not knowing what I'm supposed to know, what I think I'm supposed to know, or when a problem goes, it's like, well, I hadn't run into that problem before, you know, and that takes a minute to sort of settle, and then I realize it. But like my world experience, man, like I don't know, I'm always jealous of other, I'm always envious of other people's world experiences. It's only really when I get to talk to people like you that I'm like, oh man, I have done some stuff, you know, like, 'cause I'm constantly looking at the next thing. And so only since I moved to North Adams have I really started to settle into this place and be like, oh yeah, man, like I've traveled. I don't have that urge to jump around and do these other things. I mean, I still can't sit still for 10 minutes, but like I'm more interested in sort of sharpening my focus of the work that I want to do. And I feel like all of it has gotten me to this place now, you know, where we talked about this podcast as being a thing that we could both share our love for music and food and why they both bring things together. And I think that that's both of us sharpening the focus of our passions towards this one point, which is like, you know, global takeover, right? That's what we're doing this for, right?
Yeah. Oh, totally.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Make sure. Yeah. 'Cause I've been writing my manifesto. I want to make sure that I've got it right. Yeah.
In blood, that is. Anyways, this has been a really, insightful second episode with lots of, if you've listened to the first episode and everything went off without a hitch, the second one was a little more of a learning curve.
Sure.
And yeah. It's okay. So being a music and food podcast talking, we're going to introduce a little bit of music into the end of the episode.
One of my favorites. Yeah, one of my absolute favorites.
Yeah, so I'm been pulling all of this stuff out and just sort of surprising Aaron with whatever, like Oh Happy Day, tying into that. And then this next record we're going to play, introduce, it's not anything expensive or whatever, but it's just, it ties in so much to what we've been talking about.
Yeah.
It's King Curtis, Memphis Soul Stew, and it's bringing all the pieces together to make one hot track.
Yeah.
So, we're going to play this out, and I hope you guys listen to it and love it, and know that next time
we'll feed the dogs first.
We're going to feed the dogs first, take them out, do all of that stuff. So there's not the interruptions and the whatever, but it is what it is. Thank you so much for listening to us talk, and I hope it's coherent and really resonating with people.
Yeah, and thanks for letting me drone on for an hour this morning, Gabe.
Dude, I love it. Love it so much. But so here it is, King Curtis, Memphis Soul Stew. I hope you guys have a great week.
Today's yeah, man. Thanks
Memphis
again.
Soul Stew. We sell so much of this, people wonder what we put in it. We're going to tell you right now. Give me about a half a teacup of base. Now I need a pound of fat bag drums. Now give me 4 tablespoons of ballin' Memphis guitars. This gonna taste all right. Now just a little pinch of organ.